Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to today's program at the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Jim Doyle, a member of the club's International Relations Forum and your chair for today. We welcome our radio listeners and we invite our audiences to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's now my pleasure and honor, being the coordinator of the program today, to introduce our distinguished speaker. Our speaker is Figre Tolosa, Ph.D., is an Ethiopian poet, playwright, and scholar who has published over 30 books and articles in Amharic, German, and English. He has taught in different universities in Germany and the U.S. He has also staged some of his plays in the U.S. and Ethiopia. He has made a feature film called Multicolored Flowers, and this provoked great discussion in the U.S., Canada, Europe, and Ethiopia. His verses have appeared in books and anthologies of international poets and writers, including Nobel laureates, a German composer who loved his poems, has composed music based on his lyrics. He is also a motivational speaker and addresses different institutions, universities. His topic today for this program is Land Grab in Africa, the Case of Ethiopia. Though Africa is no longer threatened by armed colonizers, foreign exploiters are threatening Ethiopian farmers by obtaining fertile land from African leaders. The government of many African countries are benefiting from these land transactions, but the people are left impoverished and hungry. Tolosa will suggest ways to improve the desperate situation for the Ethiopian farmers. So at this time, Land Grab in Africa, the Case for Ethiopia, of Ethiopia, we welcome Figre Tolosa to present his program tonight at the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I understand that some of you have been Peace Corps volunteers to Africa. Is that right? Are there any Peace Corps volunteers here?
Not Africa.
Where were you?
Malaysia.
Malaysia, okay. That's good. Okay, my title today is Land Grab in Africa, the Case of Ethiopia. In the inglorious past, European colonizers grabbed by force any African lands they had their eyes set on and did whatever they desired to do with the lands. Not only they did exploit the lands, but also the natives by paying them meagerly to till their lost lands. Now it is a sort of neocolonialism. The land grabbers are not Europeans, they are Asians and even richer Africans. And they don't employ military force to secure the lands. They pay the African governments. At the root of the land grab lie global food shortage due to drought, population explosion, price hikes, and lack of fertile arable lands. This has immediate and long-lasting consequences. The immediate consequence is that the owners of the lands will be dislocated with their ancient villages destroyed and forced to till their own lands for a meager wage if they are lucky enough to get hired by the foreigners that have grabbed their lands. The long-term consequence is that these fertile lands will lose their trees, topsoil, natural habitats, and rivers to be rendered barren as a result of exposition to chemicals latent in the fertilizers, insecticides, and pesticides. If any rivers and lakes survive evaporation, they are likely to be poisoned by toxic materials and become undrinkable and health hazardous. So far, those aspiring to acquire African lands are India, Saudi Arabia, Libya, Egypt, and even Pakistan and Turkey. Libya is involved in Mali. India, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Turkey, and Egypt are present in Ethiopia. The governments of Sudan, Mozambique, Kenya, Uganda, and Zambia, too, are inviting such entrepreneurs to come and exploit their lands as if this is a good thing to do. Ethiopia allows exploiters to use Ethiopian lands for a maximum of 99 years. Chief among the food-producing firms that plan to exploit Ethiopia are the Indian Karuturi and Verdanta Harvests. An online India news source titled Pro Kerala states this, quote, I quote, Ethiopia has offered to Indian investors 1.8 million hectares of farmland, equaling nearly 40% the total area of principal grain-growing states of Punjab, in what could give a big push to the country's food security. The land offered by the East African nation at the horn of the continent equals 50% of the cultivable land of Punjab, often called India's granary, accounting for 23% of its wheat and 10% of paddy output. Quote, unquote. Mr. Tafarra Derbao, Ethiopia Minister of Agriculture, said, I quote, how much land will actually go to Indian investors depends entirely on the interest of the investors. If they come and take all the land, they are welcome. So far, we have transferred 307,000 hectares of land to foreign domestic investors. Some 99% of this land has been transferred to Indian companies. This land is on 70-year lease. We are now proposing to transfer another 3.6 million hectares of land to investors from overseas. And I am confident that more than half of these 3.6 million hectares will go to Indians. Unquote. Broadly speaking, Indian firms have interest in cultivating cotton, palm oil, rubber, oil seeds, and horticulture. Such sorts of products needs heavy mechanized form of farming that involves concentrated chemicals and monoculture. The target regions in Ethiopia are the fertile lands of Gambela, Afar, Ogaden, and Benshangul Gumuz in particular, and all arable lands in general. The people that are earmarked for dislocation from Gambela alone are about 225,000, consisting of 45,000 families and 49 villages. They will be resettled not too far from the lands they have been dispossessed of, so that they will be an ideal resource for cheap labor should the need arise. After having lost their vast lands, they will end up owning a tiny piece of land, 1.3 hectares per family. According to a reliable source, many Punjabi farmers are heading to Gambela and other regions of Ethiopia for settlement. They and their descendants have every right to farm these lands and live on them for the next 70 to 99 years and beyond. Moreover, they will export every grain they harvest to India or to wherever they generate hard currency based. Nothing is left for Ethiopian farmers. From the perspective of the native, this is tantamount to neo-colonization, whether the investors, quote-unquote, paid the government or not. That's how every colonization that we know of in history began. First come a group of people. They settle on the base land of the natives. They grow rich over the years. More and more people flow in, following in their footsteps, claiming the utilization of the lands belonging to their kith and kin. They give birth to children. Their grandchildren multiply and take more and more lands. They become stronger and stronger economically and then politically. While the natives get poorer and poorer economically and become politically inconsequential. They will be citizens of that country by virtue of their births in it, but their loyalty and allegiance will be to the place of their origins. Eventually, the natives become outcasts in their own countries. Besides being poor economically, they are devastated psychologically and culturally, feeling inferior to their colonizers. They end up being servants and maidservants of the colonizers. Ultimately, they are dehumanized, segregated, and discriminated against. That's how colonies in Africa started and ended up. That's exactly what happened in South Africa and Kenya. To cite only two examples. What makes the current colonization of Africa slightly different is that this is colonization by invitation, as a well-seasoned Ethiopian patriot put it. What Europeans couldn't achieve by military might, as in the case of Ethiopia, Asians are attaining by a bit of cash. China, too, has a huge vested interest in Ethiopia. The most populous nation on Earth next to India is China. These nations are densely populated. They seek for sparsely populated and fertile areas to settle their overcrowded people. The first step to achieve this is to acquire some lands as a foothold overseas. Once they secure a foothold, before the natives realize and notice it, they can grow astronomically in number and take over the new lands. And even countries, gradually. Since they are emerging as superpowers, if necessary, they can use force of arms to attain their ultimate takeover. The situation is not as simple as the Ethiopian government thinks. It's either unable to see the big picture and its grave implications, or it's deliberately turning a blind eye for temporary financial gains. Surely, it's only focused on the immediate hard cash it charges the land grabbers at present. It proves that it is nonchalant to the well-being of the future generations of Ethiopians. It seems to say, like the selfish donkey, may not a blade of grass grow once I am dead and gone. What's the Ethiopian government's rationale behind allowing foreigners to get fertile Ethiopian lands and virgin forests? One of its arguments is that Ethiopia has a plenty of uncultivated lands. This, however, is a poor argument. A government that cares for the well-being of its people doesn't give away its natural resources to foreigners simply because it has a plenty of it. Every good government should protect its national reserve, bearing in mind future generations. Even though Ethiopians are not utilizing all their lands at present, there would come a time when they will do so due to population explosion and scarcity of arable lands. Even if this argument had any validity, the lands the so-called investors have targeted to utilize are not uncultivated lands. They want to take over lands that have already been cultivated by the dwellers. If not, why would they dislocate the native farmers from the places they have farmed and lived in from time immemorial? The second argument of the government is that the investors will create jobs for the natives and improve their livelihood by helping them to create infrastructures such as roads, schools, clinics, and better housing. Judging by the settlement of Punjabi farmers in Gambela, the prospect of the natives to work there and benefit financially is null and void. The infrastructure will serve only those Punjabis more than anybody else. After all, why should Punjabi farmers create jobs for Ethiopian farmers? The Ethiopian farmers were not jobless. They had a job all the year round for ages cultivating their own lands. Why should they lose their lands and jobs just to work for others on their own lands? Isn't this absurd? A third argument of the government is that conceding lands to Indian farmers will generate Indian technology transfer to Ethiopia, including the construction of railroads and sugar factories. This argument, too, is lame. The international food producing firms such as Karuturi and Verdanta Harvests are neither technology transferring agents nor have they any influence on any such entities. If the Ethiopian government is after technology transfer, it should directly deal with the concerned entities that are engaged in this business, instead of donating arable lands belonging to millions of Ethiopians to achieve this. India has a population of 1.2 billion people, yet she is not known begging for food from foreign countries to feed her people. Ethiopia, with only 80 million people, does depend on foreign aid for food if her lands don't grow for food, as if her lands don't grow food. India plans to farm Ethiopian lands to meet its shortage of food. Isn't this ironical? Officially, the investors are acquiring arable lands at a very cheap price, even cheaper than Indian lands. However, no one but the government knows exactly how much money it receives from the investors in addition to the token or formal officially disclosed prices. Furthermore, it is not revealed where the money goes. Does it go into the government treasury for national use, or does it fill the pockets of a few high-profile individuals? Transparency and accountability are lacking terribly. No open debate is even permissible to discuss the merit and demerit of this phenomenon of this proportion, which can cause dislocation of people, the devastation of top and bottom soils, plants, animals, rivers, and lakes. The government of Ethiopia knows full well that the Ethiopian farmers will benefit nothing from the land grab. On the contrary, it is self-evident that they will be impoverished even more. So, why is it leasing arable lands and virgin forces at such an alarming rate? Why all this haste? Of course, at the heart of all this lies finance. When Atto Mulla Zenawi, the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, was asked what the Ethiopian farmers would gain from the land grab, he was reported to have spoken point blank that the investors were not in Ethiopia for charity reasons. They were there for a return of their investments. As such, they were entitled to do whatever they liked with the lands they had acquired, paying for them in hard currency. Such a statement is not befitting the leader of a nation that is supposed to protect. It is indeed disheartening and sobering. It is obvious that the government of Ethiopia is not preserving and safeguarding the national reserve and natural resources of the country. As long as the best bidders pay for them in hard currency that the government needs terribly. If Ethiopian lands are capable of being farmed and feeding millions of Indians, Saudi Arabians, Egyptians, Pakistanis, and Turks, why shouldn't they be cultivated by Ethiopian farmers to feed themselves and to export the leftover or the surplus harvest to earn hard currency? Is it because there aren't any Ethiopian agronomists that can make this happen? No, I don't think so. There are many capable Ethiopian farmers that can undertake this. Is it because of lack of finance? Maybe. This is where the Ethiopian government should step in. The government should encourage Ethiopian farmers and assist them financially and otherwise with the same intensity it initiates foreign food companies to lease Ethiopian lands. Not only encourage them to farm, but farm organically. The foreign firms, as stated earlier, will apply mechanized farming and infest the lands and waters with chemicals, thus contributing to the barrenness of the earth in the long run after a few bumper harvests. On top of this, they will practice monoculture by planting only one kind of product on a vast amount of land, such as cotton, tobacco, rubber, oil seeds, and horticulture. If pestilence strikes, all of them will be devastated. The flower beds that some Dutch companies have exploited in Ethiopia are not yielding any more as in the past due to intensive exposition to chemicals that have become hazardous to the environment and the inhabitants. More and more Ethiopians are now afflicted by cancer because of exposition to such toxic chemicals. If the Ethiopian government would initiate Ethiopian farmers to launch organic farming in the form of mixed farming, nonetheless, they can use natural manure as fertilizers, grow, among other plants, leguminous seeds such as beans, peas, and clover that generate nitrates in the soil. And that could be harvested twice in a year. The stems of these plants could be used as cooking charcoal, saving rain-causing trees from being cut for firewood, and protecting them so that they could, in return, protect soils from erosion. And if pestilence hits one of the plants, the rest will survive to feed the farmers, contrary to monoculture that causes the devastation of the entire farm. Hence, the solution for Ethiopia's underdevelopment in general and the problem of her farmers in particular is not to concede arable lands to foreign investors, but rather to empower Ethiopian farmers to preserve their own lands, cultivating them organically, harvest chemical-free foods, consume them first and foremost and export the surplus to countries like India, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Turkey, Pakistan, and Israel. I urge the government of Ethiopia to stop conceding to foreigners the natural resources and the national reserves of the people of Ethiopia, and to begin helping Ethiopian farmers preserve and farm their lands organically. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any arable land. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any arable land left in Ethiopia 20 years from now, resulting in more drought, famine, ecological disaster, and most of all, the annihilation of human life. If the Ethiopian government is not willing to reserve, or reverse, rather, if the Ethiopian government is not willing to reverse its decision, it should at least review thoroughly the terms of the concessions. First and foremost, it must shorten the duration of the lease not to exceed 15 years at a time, unless the investors are Ethiopians or of Ethiopian descent. It could be renewable after that upon a mutual agreement of both parties. Second, the government should enforce a strict labor code pertaining to minimum wage scale, collective bargaining power, as well as medical and retirement benefits for both the skilled and unskilled Ethiopian employees that would work for the cultivators. Third, the government should see to it that both skilled and unskilled Ethiopians are employed in these projects, since it claims that one of the reasons why it leases the lands is to create jobs for Ethiopians. As it now stands, the Punjabis seem to be keen on filling in the farms with their own workers. Most of all, it should see to it that the environment, soil, air, water, etc., is protected against chemicals that would endanger nature, natural habitats, and human life. In fact, it should encourage organic farming all over Ethiopia. Fourth, it should control the flow of human traffic, that is, the number of foreign-born employees and their families entering Ethiopia to settle on their farms. Such measures can temporarily minimize otherwise catastrophic damages which will compromise the very existence of Ethiopia. Thank you. And here I would like to pass on some pictures of the villages and fields, farming fields, that are likely to be destroyed soon or are in the plan to be destroyed. So you can pass it on. Everybody can look and turn the pages and look and then pass them on, please. And so shall we make it open for questions?
All right. Before we start the questions, I was just giving a reminder to – we'd like to remind our listening audience that this program is with Dr. Figre – it's the Commonwealth Club of California with Dr. Figre Tolosa, and you're listening to his program on land grab in Africa, the case of Ethiopia. So right now we can start with the questions, so audience members can go over to the microphone. Or we can have someone assist with the microphone. Okay, raise your hand, person over here. Raise your hand, and we'll give them the microphone. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Question. Can you hear me? Yes, okay. Question, if the Ethiopian farmers own the land, how is it the government takes it away from them? Is the government stealing the land, or is the government ignoring their ownership rights, or is there some eminent domain law, or what's going on there?
Okay, that's a good question. The farmers have lived on this on those lands for ages. And then we had monarchy before. During the monarchy, some feudal lords owned those lands, and then the farmers worked as tenants. Then there broke a revolution in 1974, which gave lands to the tillers, and so the landlords were gone, the feudal lords. And the farmers, the tillers of the land, got the lands. The government had power to give lands to the tillers. It was nationalized, though. The government was the landlord. In effect, the government became the landlord. And then when that military communist government was overthrown by a group of guerrilla fighters who used to be students who rebelled against this military regime, then they too declared that land belongs to the government and not to the people. So, in effect, still, the government of Ethiopia is the landlord, and it has every right to lease those lands for 99 years. Like usually, if let's say an Ethiopian wants a land, some piece of land, a plot of land, they can lease it for 99 years, but they cannot own it. You cannot sell and transfer land to another person, because land belongs theoretically to the people, but practically by the government. So this farmers have been in this land like before the monarchy. They tilled those lands and they were landlords. Landlords were gone. Nominally, they became the landowners. Okay. Now, the current government tells them that land belongs to the government, and the government knows what is best, how to utilize these lands, and we need to farm these lands. Foreigners should come and farm them. So you have to leave this region, this fertile region, regardless of how long you've lived on it. And so that's the dilemma that we're facing right now.
Okay. Hi, thank you. I actually have two questions. I'll start with one. The first question is, I'm interested, what the farmers that are being evicted, what forms of resistance are taking place to these eviction processes, and what are the avenues that they have available to claim their lands and to claim their rights, and are any of these processes happening?
No, they cannot resist in any way except to go and complain to the officials or appeal to them. There was a case from Gambela, which is a southern, very fertile area bordering Sudan, southern Sudan. And some elderly people got together, wrote a letter, and went and saw the president of Ethiopia. It was like about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. And then he sympathized with them, and he said, oh, my gosh, I understand. So we should reserve this land. We should not let foreigners cultivate it and damage it with chemicals. He understood. And so he wrote a letter to the local functionaries that represent the central government saying, please do not lease this land to foreigners. Its result, its consequence is worse than the little money we get now from these so-called investors. But, you know, nobody would listen to him because he's a figurehead. See, the real power lies in the hands of the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, Atomal Zenawi. And he's in favor of land leasing to foreigners. And like I quoted here, the Minister of Agriculture and even the Deputy Prime Minister traveled to India begging the Indians to come and take as much land. See, you remember I read here, you know, saying that his quote. I quoted him where he said, how much land you want to acquire depends on you, Indians. You can come get as many as you can. We have 3.6 million hectares for now, and most of it can come to you. So, I mean, you can't go and beg your national reserve like that to be taken by others because they give you cash for now, you know, and then the cash is unaccountable where it is going. Yes. This way they made an attempt in a peaceful way to be listened to. But it's not working. And so the government, however, says this, we'll compensate them. We'll compensate the farmers. And they move them to another area. And like they lost vast lands and they give them now 1.3 hectares per family, and which is nothing, you know. It's just a tiny plot compared to the entire forest and virgin soils and lands and rivers that they're used to owning and cultivating for ages. Besides, they lose their villages too. They have to go elsewhere and rebuild villages. So that's how it is. And yeah, further question? Have I answered your question?
The population of Ethiopia, is it somewhat stabilized or does it seem to rise?
It's growing.
It's growing?
It's growing.
Okay.
Astronomically.
I see.
It's growing. It's 85 million and maybe I think 10 or 15 years later it's going to be 110 or 120 million. It's growing.
I have another question.
Yes.
I presume the government says that there's some urgent reason for it to do this thing and bring in money to the country. All governments, of course, say there's some urgent reason. I don't know if there's anyone that has a little color of truth or whether there's not.
The question is that first and foremost, where is this money going to? What is it needed for?
Yeah.
What's the urgency?
Yeah.
And then is the money they charge to donate or lease such lands is worth the damage and the consequence it will incur for future generations. The land and the people, the impact on the land and the people is huge and it's devastating and scary. It scares me.
Yeah. Hi, thank you for your speech. We watched at my church a film called The Dark Side of Chocolate, and it is a story of modern-day slavery in the country of Ghana. Ghana is on the west side of Africa, for people who don't know. It is kind of where the neck of the horse and the jaw come together. It's that flexure in the continent. That's where most of the black slaves in the West Indies trade came out of those ports in Ghana. What they're doing is stealing the children, and we had this all thoroughly documented on video. They're taken to Mali, which is a country bordering to the north of Ghana, and they are forced to work in the cocoa plantations. And so is this what they are starting to do in Ethiopia?
It's not quite like that in Ethiopia, but because of AIDS virus and many parents dying, leaving their children behind. And as a result of this, there are many Westerners, including Americans, who go there and adopt children, and they take them out. And it has negative and positive sides, of course. I hope that some of them wouldn't be in a devastating situation as a result of this. I hope, I mean, all will raise them as they claim when they get them out of Ethiopia. Only in that sense, but not slavery of children. But women do go to Arab countries to work, like Ethiopian young girls. They go there as maids. And they have a hard time, coping up with the Muslim world there. And sometimes it has some tragic end whereby these young girls end up committing suicides, or were they even killed their bosses because of injustice. And so this is a new phenomenon for Ethiopia. Ethiopians used to live only in Ethiopia proper for centuries, and they never went as refugees to other countries. In fact, they received refugees coming to Ethiopia and the Ethiopian Empire, including Jewish people. When Jewish people were persecuted, they found home and shelter in Ethiopia. And not only they gave them home, but they made them kings and queens and priests, high priests, opportunities they never had in Israel. So Ethiopia has been welcoming people. But unfortunately, because of the tragic events of the nation the past 35 years, they started fleeing their native lands to safer haven. And this is a new phenomenon. And most of the Ethiopians that you see in the United States are first-generation Ethiopians, immigrants, Ethiopian immigrants, whereas there are many other nations migrating to the United States. Ethiopians are probably the last and latecomers. Yes? That's a good question. The first question, during the emperor's time, it was just, you know, there was no collectivism. If the farmers got together, it was to help each other to farm each other's plot of land, and in turn another one will go to another, and they used to help each other that way. But during the communist military regime, they followed into the footsteps of Russia, and they had like collectivization of the farms and the farmers, and they used to do that. Now there are some collective cooperatives too in Ethiopia, and merchants used to go there and buy directly from them. But then now there's a young Ethiopian educated in the West. She's a doctor, PhD in her research was on food and agriculture in Ethiopia. She did it at Stanford University. And now she tries to create index of markets according to world food price or coffee price and so on, and encourages the farmers to sell it carefully and so on. But then there's a criticism of that too, saying that the government, instead of the merchants, the government buy the coffee and they sell them at their own price and so on. So this has not been yet quite settled yet. And there are also individual farmers. But I hope in the future this will stabilize and the farmers will benefit much from their harvest.
Is there a parallel? Okay. Is there a parallel situation in African countries where there are nomadic tribes, such as the Maasai? I mean, how would this kind of land grab affect a country such as Kenya or Tanzania, where there are nomads, or is it not happening there?
No, there are, even like I said, Kenya has invited also such investors in Mozambique, Uganda, and all these nations, and Zambia, they are inviting You know, it's like a trend when one African, most African countries follow Ethiopia because of Ethiopia's history and because the Organization of African Unity, which is now called United States of Africa, is located or headquartered in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. So, you know, they are now inviting left and right, everybody. And I don't trust these African governments because if they get cash right away, they might sell, you know, the lands and even the people. So this is scary because they want to get quick cash and probably not even be in the picture for the next 99 years. Since it's that long, they want to lease these lands to the foreigners. And so it's like saying, hey, I won't be around, and that's your problem. The future, let the future generation deal with it. And so it's not being far-sighted and not being considerate of future generations. So if in the case of the Maasai, if they take away their nomadic lands, that would be catastrophic. You know, they might resist, and where else will they go? Maybe they'll then keep on searching another land, since they are mobile all the time, and until they follow them and then kick them from there, and then they might turn around, go around. I don't know how it's going to be with unsettled people.
I have a question.
Yeah.
In your speech, you gave a compelling plea to the Ethiopian government with recommendations, and my question is if you think they're anything else the international community can do. It seems like right now it's up to the government in their decision, and there's no legal framework or precedence. But this is an increasing issue in more and more countries. So do you have any other recommendations?
Ethiopia is still receiving food donation. And lately, I think there are about 2.5 million people who are starving and they need food. So if Ethiopian lands could be farmed and they can feed India and other countries, it means it can yield harvest, right? So like I said, like I asked the government, why don't you use the same method and intensity of farming the same thing so that Ethiopian farmers could eat it themselves? And if there is something left, why wouldn't they would be the beneficiaries by exporting this and bringing hard cash for themselves and for the country? This tells me that it could be done if they want to. Look, Ethiopia has been famished and hungry for the past 35 years. The problem of hunger has not been solved yet. So why not solve it this way? If how much money would the investors spend on the land? Let's say 100 million on 1 million, I mean half a million hectare of land or whatever. So doesn't the Ethiopian government have $100 million? They do. They do have tons of money. They receive, even from the United States alone, I think this year's budget was $500 billion or something like this, if I don't err. And they get from Europe, from everywhere. So they have money. They could use their money if their priority was really to solve the problem of hunger. They could use Ethiopian lands. There are many arable lands. We have rivers. I mean, the source of the Blue Nile is Ethiopia, Lake Tana. And the Blue Nile flows through Sudan and waters Egypt and drains into the Mediterranean Sea. So we have even the Blue Nile, and we have many other rivers, lakes. But most of all, there have been grains that grow with little water or no water at all, with early morning dew and dampness in the olden days. There used to be seeds like that. In those days, Ethiopians and Africans didn't starve. It's only when they introduced corn, which is American, you know, product that drains a lot of water, that sucks lots of water and needs a lot of rainfall and so on and so forth. So they started depending on such foreign imported grains and even eucalyptus trees from Australia. They introduced eucalyptus trees, and eucalyptus trees needs lots of water to grow, and so it drains the surroundings. But in the olden days, they had native seeds that they abandoned and forgotten about right now. If they reintroduce those seeds and plant them, they can grow in deserts, even in rocks. There have been seeds that grow in rocks without any water. So these have passed millions of years of ecology, and they're capable of feeding Ethiopians and Africans, and some roots that grow in the desert that you can take and eat, and they sustain you for a long time. So malpractice of agriculture has also contributed to this. And then, fertilizer and chemicals are the worst enemies. People used to farm using organic fertilizers such as manures and other stuff. And they abandoned those, and they're applying heavy mechanized agriculture and monoculture also. If you plant, let's say, cotton, tobacco, cotton, cocoa, like on and on and on till your eyes could see, as far as your eyes could see. And if anything happens, if there's pestilence, all of them are devastated and destroyed. But if it's mixed farming and you have all kinds of plants, if one is hit by pestilence or any disease, the rest will survive, and the farmers can eat them and survive. One. Two, the fertilizers and the pesticides and insecticides have lots of chemicals that sink under the earth. They could give bumper harvest for a few times, and after that it's totally dry and barren. And India has this experience. And Indian farmers have been protesting the usage of fertilizers in their own lands. But if they get Ethiopian lands, they wouldn't mind. I mean, the capitalists, the investors, wouldn't mind getting a few bumper harvest and then abandon those lands. And the Ethiopian government seems to lose sight of this. The damage because of the chemicals involved is horrendous. And that's what scares me, because after a while, you can't use the soil, the water, the air, and causes illnesses, disease. Animals are gone. When you cut the trees to farm the lands, animals flee, maybe to Kenya, to other places, or they die. And so it's really ecologically damaging and very devastating thing. And the governments are not seeing far. They're just interested in the cash they can get today, and so on and so forth. Yes.
I wanted to ask you a follow-up question about the domestic media in Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. You said at one point that there was not very much domestic conversation, but you also gave an example of the prime minister being posed a question and then answering. But I wondered if you could say a little bit more about the role, if any, that the newspapers or the media in general is playing. Mostly in Ethiopia, but also if you know of anything that's been going on in Ethiopia.
Oh,
yeah,
you're talking about press freedom and so on?
Yeah.
Okay. During the reign of the Emperor Haile Selassie, there were only government newspapers, and you couldn't say a word. You know, you didn't have private newspapers. And so basically there was no freedom of expression and writing and so on. When he was toppled over for the first few years until the military consolidated itself, there was a lot of freedom of speech and the press. Then when the military government became stronger and stronger, it disbanded all this. And you couldn't breathe a word against the rulers and the system and all that. When the military government was overthrown by the EPRDF guerrilla fighters, and they took over. So there was a transitional period again, whereby, you know, they had to be generous and let people speak the way they want, you know, criticizing the past governments and so on and so forth. And even they themselves, you know, they wanted to assume that they were better democratic than the previous government, right? Every new government always gives the impression that it is more democratic than the previous, than its predecessor, to stay in power and to win over the public to its side at the initial stage, in the beginning. But later, when it consolidates its power, then it becomes, you know, harsh again. And so there was such a lull, and there was, you know, democracy was flourishing in that sense for about 7-8 years. And then after that, the people started also criticizing the government. And then they would call the editors and the writers, and, you know, harass them or tell them, you know, what you've written against us, and that's wrong, and where did you get your source from, reveal it, and then bail them, you know, release them on bail or keep them a few years in jail. So these things have happened, and it's still happening. Right now, it's relatively better than the previous regimes, but still, it's not completely, you know, independent.
Sure. I was just wondering the extent to which the Ethiopian papers were covering these land deals.
Which one? You mean the government or the public?
I don't know. That's a question for you to answer.
But
I guess the private newspapers.
What do they cover?
Are they covering these land deals, and are they expressing opinions about
them? Yeah, the private papers cover the land deals, and the government also, in retaliation to that or in response to that, they also justify their sides. But they don't speak much to the government about it, except the prime minister said, well, they could do whatever they like as long as they pay in cash for it, And I don't like this kind of response, because it seems that he didn't see the long-term consequences of giving land, leasing land to foreigners who might damage the land and nature, animals and human lives and so on and so forth.
From what you say, it sounds like the government is the number one culprit. You've partly addressed this, but looking back on Ethiopian history, what do you see as the best government they've had, the best period?
The best governments were in the olden days, when Ethiopia was administering Egypt, Nubia, Arabia, Libya, Asia even. By the way, do you know that Asia is called Asia because of Emperor Asia L of Ethiopia, who went to Asia and then... He appointed many kings, and he told them, I'm king of kings, I'm your emperor, govern the people well, and so if you don't, I'll come and get you. And he gave them constitution, law, and so he's called Emperor Asia El. So in those days, and then Aksumite, the founder of the city of Aksum, he was called the father of the world, because people from Iraq, Mesopotamia, from Ethiopian empires, from Arabia, came to complain to him when their own local kings abused them and mistreated them. So those days, you know, were good. And in fact, I remember a case where Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, mistreated his people, and Aksumite emperor, who was his boss, told him, look, God has given us so much land. Why do you take away the people's land? I'm going to get you unless you return the lands to these poor people. So there were such times.
So the golden age was many centuries.
We've reached the point in the program, unfortunately, that we have time for one last question. So does someone have one last question? No, okay. Does someone? No, last question. Okay. So at this time, we'd like to give a special thanks to Dr. Figre Tolosa on his topic, Land Grab in Africa, the Case of Ethiopia. He also has a book called The Hidden and Untold History of the Jewish People and Ethiopians, and also the alumni of the Peace Corps alumni group was partly helped out with this program and was sponsor of the program or helping out with the program, so we want to acknowledge them. And we also like to thank our audience here at the club as well as the radio audience. We are now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating the 108th anniversary of enlightened discussion is adjourned.